Okay, so onto the section around 10%, which obviously ties us right into what we've been covering in the main show regarding the rise of the 12-inch single. So Walter Gibbons was tenacious in his pursuit of music, and according to Mark Zimmer, he, and I quote, knew how to be a little aggressive, close quote, in order to have his name added to the door list of a club or get promotional records. On one occasion, Walter showed Zimmer a top 20 list that had been published and asked him if he noticed anything peculiar about it. Mark told me, "I took a good look and I said, oh, every song is from a different record company." Walter knew how to use these lists to his advantage because that meant he could call the companies and say, "Look, I have your record in my list." If it was a top 40 list, he would have listed records from 40 different companies. Reminds me a little bit of Arthur Russell, seemingly quite shy, but actually, very clever and ready to push himself forward if there was an opportunity to get into a recording studio, basically. The outlook served Walter well when he approached Salsol, a newly formed independent label, and offered to promote their records for free, as long as he did not have to pay for them. Ken Carey, the owner of the company, who I remember interviewing extensively and very happily for Love Saves the Day, told me Walter was very aggressive when it came to searching out new records. He became friendly with Denise Chapman, our promotions girl, and we went to hear him play. I was very impressed with his skills. With only a limited background in music, Ken Carey had put Salsol on the map by persuading the Philadelphia international musicians Vince Montana on vibes, Ronnie Baker on bass, Norman Harris on guitar, and Earl Young on drums to play on the Salsol Hustle, which was released in 1975, which referenced Van McCoy's smash hit The Hustle, which had come out earlier that year. So let's have just a very quick listen to Salsol Hustle, which I think might have been Salsol's second release, or certainly a very early release after the Joe Patan debut. Ken Carey then attempted to build on the success of The Hustle, which was Salsol's commercial breakthrough, if you like, when he commissioned the Philadelphia band Double Exposure to record the album 10%, which came out in 1976. In order to promote the album's title single, Ken Carey released a non-commercial promotional 12-inch test pressing of the 6-minute 50-second album version, which consisted of the standard single plus an extended jam. When inquisitiveness led him to go and hear Walter Gibbons play at Galaxy 21, the DJ worked two copies of the promo in his trademark fashion. So this is an early non-commercial version that's just slightly extended. Released by Salsol for just DJ play, and this is what Walter is reworking live. So Ken Carey went to hear Walter play with Denise Chapman, and he told me he did this fantastic edit, and the reaction in the club was phenomenal. I said, "Can you do that in the studio?" He said he could. Having been impressed by the seriousness and diligence displayed by Walter in his dealings with Salsol, Ken Carey concluded that the DJ was atypical of his peers and could be entrusted with the remix. According to Tony Smith, Walter was interested in remixing 10% because the record was more progressive than the label's attempt to compete with Van McCoy. I mean, that record, The Hustle, isn't a favorite, let's put it that way. By this point, the collective desire for extended mixes was tangible. Ever since they had started to play extended sets, New York's Insomniac Spinners had sought out long experimental album cuts that would enable their dancers to lose themselves in the music. And because these cuts were scarce, they had also adopted the habit of buying two copies of a 7-inch single in order to extend an original recording by its 3 to 4 minute limit. Scepter Records' Mel Sherum was the first record company executive to respond to the demand, and having commissioned Tom Moulton to remix Do It Till You're Satisfied by BT Express, We listened to that on the main show. And Dreamworld by Don Downing, which we also listened to, both of them squeezed onto 7-inch singles. Then he released Bobby Moore's Call Me Your Anything Man as a promo-only 12-inch dance single in June 75. We listened to that as well. That was a Tom Moulton, another Tom Moulton mix. Although there is some dispute as to whether the Bobby Moore remix amounted to the first 12-inch dance release, the fact that remixes of I'll Be Holding On by Al Downing, So Much for Love by Moment of Truth, Baby Save Me by Secrets, and Train Called Freedom by South Shore Commission can also lay claim to that honour, highlights the way that these are other records that might have been the first 12-inches. In the end, it's hard to know because often it's hard to tell what month these were released. Anyway, the fact that so many of them can lay claim to the honour of being the first 12-inch single highlights the way that discotheque and party-based DJs and disco-friendly labels were set on establishing an extended dance format. Ken Carey's contribution turned out to be twofold. He was the first label head to grasp that the 12-inch single would appeal to dancers as well as DJs in terms of wanting to buy the thing, and accordingly released 10% as the first commercially available 12-inch single. He also understood that despite their lowly position within the music industry, discotheque DJs were more adept than producers when it came to grasping the way the dynamic of the dance floor might be transposed onto vinyl. So he commissioned Walter to team up with the engineer Bob Blank to produce a remix of 10%. They were given 3 hours to complete the job, in effect 1 hour to put up the mix and channel the sound, 1 hour to break down the recording, and 1 hour to cut up tape with a razor blade. As Bob Blank told me, of course, Bob went on to become, you know, one of, if not the most revered engineer in the dance scene of the late 70s and early 80s. Bob said, Walter was prepared, but he couldn't prepare everything. He had to be ready to do brain work on the spur of the moment. The session was very intuitive. Walter was a real genius. By the end of the session, the diminutive DJ, Walter was a small guy, had transformed the album version of 10% into a 9-minute, 45-second roller coaster that stretched out the rhythm section, the strings, and T.G. Conway's keyboards. Okay, let's have a listen to the 12-inch. I know we've heard it before, but let's have another little musical break and listen to that record just that little bit more. Walter was paid $185 for his efforts, which was $85 to cover a night's work at Galaxy 21, plus $100 for the mix. And he started as Spin and Acetate of the remix, which was effectively a ready-made version of the lightning-quick collages he had already been creating at Galaxy 21 in late February, early March 1976. This we know because it starts to get mentioned in Disco Files by Vince Aletti, I believe, another... Tom Moulton's column in Billboard as well. I forget where exactly this information is. Oh no, actually, maybe it was even Mixmaster, a new sheet that was coming out that I got hold of. Released in May, the remix captured the way in which disco's novel aesthetic was beginning to influence wider music culture. So as Michael Gomes, who was a very close mate of Nicky Siano's and... you know, very involved at the gallery and also started to edit this new sheet called Mixmaster, which was very informative as well as very kind of insightful and colourful and witty. As Michael told me, I heard it on acetate in the gallery, Nicky Siano's gallery. It sounded so new going backwards and forwards. It built and built like it would never stop. The dance floor just exploded. There's a new aesthetic coming through. To the frustration of Rich Flores, Walter took the tapes to be mastered at Sunshine Sound, which would go on to become a significant rival also to Angel Sound. Rich Flores told me, Walter could have easily said to me, would you like to master the 10% 12-inch? He could have said, hey, Rich, are you eating good? That's my one resentment with Walter. Rich Flores would have probably landed the job if he and Gibbons had not broken up toward the beginning of 1975, having released something like 250 to 350 acetates on Melting Pot. So sales of the 10% 12-inch single quickly outstripped the regular 7-inch by 2-1, but the record's original architects were disappointed with the result. So the co-writer of the song, Alan Felder, told me, the mixer cut up the lyrics and changed the music. It was as if the writers and producers were nothing. So here we have an example of the kind of established industry, if you like, overseeing the production and release of music, were kind of completely startled and somewhat upset at the intrusions of the DJ and the way they were re-emerging, just kind of, chopping up and changing their records in a seemingly careless way. It's not like Alan Felder was some old industry guy. I did interview him for Love Saves the Day, and he's an incredibly sweet guy. So I don't want to, it's not just they were a bunch of reactionaries, but and songwriters obviously take care over how they put their words together, so you can understand his point of view. Alan Felder's outlook was widely shared in the 1970s. DJs were widely regarded as musical parasites, and the idea that someone like Walter Gibbons should be given carte blanche to remix an original work of art, in inverted commas, was doggedly opposed. But Ken Carey understood their potential importance. As he told me, Walter was the first DJ to show the record companies that they should be open to different versions of a song. They were in the club night after night, so they knew what worked and what didn't work. Walter was pivotal. He convinced producers and other record companies to give the DJs an opportunity to remix records for the clubs. And he showed us that these records could be commercially successful. People didn't believe that that was possible before 10%. Walter was a pioneer. Okay, we're almost there. So Walter remixed Sun, Sun, Sun by Jackie, spelt with two Ks, around the same time he worked on 10%. Produced by Johnny Melfi and released on Pyramid as a 12-inch in 1976, the record sleeve information contained no reference to Walter. But Denise Chapman, who was nicknamed Sunshine because of her cheerful personality, remembers that Walter phoning her up to tell her he was remixing the record. She told me, Walter called me and said, Sunshine, Sunshine, Sunshine. Then he told me the name of the record, so Sun, Sun, Sun. The remix, and I think the lyrics indeed, quote Sunshine, I think, as well. I'd have to re-listen. Let's have a little re-listen to that record.